My name is Michael McCusker. Happy spring. The vernal equinox has come and gone. I do wish that they'd maybe held off. Daylight savings, perhaps another month, so it wouldn't be so dark when we get up in the mornings. But I guess they're getting very anxious to have those long afternoons so they can sell things in their stores. I understand it's a completely commercial thing. At any rate, I'd like to, before I start the gist of the program, read a letter I just wrote to the Daily Astorian, which may or may not print it. It's in regards to a recent article, actually appeared in the Monday afternoon edition. To the editor, is the replication of a combat soldier into a digital action figure in a computer war game a new form of military decoration? Where would it rank with the Medal of Honor? How does Pat Tillman figure into such a concept? The former pro football champion who enlisted in the Army and was killed by so-called friendly fire in Afghanistan. The Army attempted to cover up the circumstances of his death by posthumously awarding him a Silver Star, claiming he died heroically fighting the enemy. Would he have been resurrected as a computerized action figure if the Army had been successful in its deception? Ironically, it was Tillman's own family, especially his mother, who refused to abide the lie, which they thought degraded other soldiers who truly earned their medals. So is this action figure fabrication and TV game show appearances by soldiers back stateside from the wars in the Middle East a hot new style of propaganda as well as a recruiting campaign concocted by the same smarmy militarists who falsely idolatrized Tillman until his mother spanked them? Exploiting real veterans as computer action figures for video games is obviously one of the latest schemes of war profiteering. And that's something I wrote, a letter to the editors of the Daily Astorian, which may or may not print it. And I suppose I should say that that's my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos, my disclaimer. Well, tomorrow is the centennial of the shirtwaist factory fire. And I'd like to read something. I'll introduce it first with something I wrote a few years back. The 20th century started with more than 5 million women working at outside employment, about one-fifth of all U.S. women. The greatest increase was in clerical work, which employed primarily white women. Two other areas of dramatic increase were telephone operators and sales clerks. Nearly 30% of jobs for women were as domestic workers, a large percentage black and immigrants. Others worked on farms as teachers or in factories, primarily garment or textile. In 1909, women shirtwaist workers attempted to organize at two companies in New York City, were fired, and immediately formed a picket line. They persevered despite arrests and beatings by police. Called the Uprising of the 20,000, it was the largest strike of women workers to date. They did not win many of their demands, but were supported by the Women's Trade Union League and proved that women were able to organize. 2 years later, on March 25, 1911, fire broke out at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory where the 1909 strike began. Exits were locked against the law, and fire ladders were unable to reach the top floors, so 146 workers, most of them young immigrant women, jumped into the street, or burned to death. Rose Schneiderman gave an impassioned speech, and thousands of mourners marched down Fifth Avenue. "This is not the first time girls have been burned alive in this city," Schneiderman said. "Every week I must learn of the untimely death of one of my sister workers. Too much blood has been spilled. I know from my experience it is up to working people to save themselves. The only way they can save themselves is by a strong working class movement," unquote. And that's Rose Schneiderman. And of course she meant unions, which are being picked on and attempted to be destroyed again. And as a little footnote, the shirtwaist factory owners were acquitted following investigation that was as corrupt as it was scandalous. And what I'd like to read appeared in the New York Times this past Sunday, "Out of a Tragedy, a Mission to Remember the Triangle Fire." "I grew up with this story, and I've always wanted to do something about it," Ruth Sergel said. "It's like a black hole in your heart." In 2004, Ms. Sergel started doing something about the story she grew up with, the Triangle Waste Company fire, which killed 146 garment workers in 1911. She had just read a book about the fire to distract herself from worrying about the premiere of a short film she had directed at the Tribeca Film Festival. At the end of the book was a list of names and addresses of the victims, many of them within blocks of her apartment on East 3rd Street. Eager to do something about the story that had created a black hole in her heart, she hit upon what she called the schmaltziest idea. On March 25th, tomorrow, the anniversary of the fire, 100 years ago, she and some friends divided up the names and fanned out across the neighborhood. In front of each building where a victim had lived, they chalked a name, age, and cause of death in white, green, pink, and purple, often with drawings of flowers, tombstones, or a triangle. Pauline Horowitz, age 19, lived at 58 St. Mark's Place, died March 25, 1911, Triangle Factory Fire. And Albina Caruso, age 20, lived at 21 Bowery, died March 25, 1911, Triangle Factory Fire. "After you chalk one or two names, something starts to happen," said Ms. Sergel, 48, an artist who cobbles a living from grant to grant. "If there are two victims across the street from each other, you wonder, did they walk to work together? Did their families console each other? The whole rest of the year, you associate those buildings with that person." Year by year, the chalking project has multiplied. For this year's centennial, it is one of more than 100 events scheduled over the coming week, many of them organized by Ms. Sergel, head of the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition, which she founded in 2008. Workers United, which descended from the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, is the chief sponsor of the main ceremony at the former factory site on Friday, which is tomorrow. Ms. Sergel's coalition is coordinating concerts, plays, readings, exhibitions, and processions, urging firehouses and churches to ring their bells at 4:45 p.m. tomorrow, and offering an interactive map of the victims' addresses and an open archive where people can post photographs. And, of course, that will be at 1:45 p.m. here on the West Coast. "What's important to us isn't abstract histories, but things that are grounded in the personal and tangible," Ms. Sergel said. "Our role is to shift from just collecting stories and broadcasting them to creating opportunities for conversation. The daughter of a playwright and a poet, Ms. Sergel grew up in Lower Manhattan, went to Swarthmore College, and worked as an assistant on several films before directing some shorts, including Bruce, about a dancer with cerebral palsy, and Belle, about an 86-year-old retiree. In 2008, she earned a master's degree in interactive media from New York University. Last fall, she married a Swiss dramaturge. She is not quite sure of the origin of her fascination with the fire or with what she calls communal memory. Perhaps it was that her stepfather, Nathan Farb, was a photographer, forever capturing images of the past. Or maybe it stems from growing up a block away from Washington Market, the city's main produce market, until it was demolished in the 1960s to make way for the World Trade Center. Now, of course, both the market and the towers that replaced it are left to communal memory. After the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, Ms. Sergel helped the photographer Gilles Perez and others compile a collection of images for an exhibition and a book. Then came Voices of 9/11, in which she recorded 550 family members and survivors telling their memories of that day. Ms. Sergel has dwelled deeply on the parallels between the Triangle Fire and 9/11. The truth is that so much of it is absolutely arbitrary about who survived and who didn't, she said. So much depended on which floor you were on, especially in Tower 1. If you were above a certain floor, you were not going to get out. If you were below, you were going to get out. In the Triangle Fire, if you were on the 8th floor or 10th floor, most were able to get out. If you were on the 9th floor, you were often stuck. The fire, started by a cigarette, began on the 8th floor. Most workers there escaped by the stairs, and those on the 10th ran up to the roof. But the workers on the 9th floor did not receive an alert and leaped to their deaths in desperation. Ms. Sergel's coalition has grown from half a dozen historians, artists, and preservationists to more than 200 individuals and organizations. It has a budget of $60,000, including a $30,000 grant from a foundation connected to the Garment Workers Union. In addition to connecting artists, educators, union workers, and city officials on triangle-related matters, Ms. Sergel is forever updating the coalition's website and posting items on Facebook and Twitter, like this tidbit last month, quote, "Please check out this beautiful piece by Eileen Nevitt, granddaughter of Annie Sprinsock, who survived the fire," unquote. While Workers United marks each anniversary with a ceremony, Ms. Sergel has broadened it to the art world and to young people, said Mei Chen, a retired union official. I was moved by her asking, what did this particular incident of workers dying spark the imagination? Or why did this particular incident of workers dying spark the imagination? Annie Lanzolotto, a self-described rock poet who has chalked for the past 4 years, recalled once encountering several immigrant workers on a break outside a Chinese restaurant. They asked me what I was doing, and I told them what happened here 100 years ago, said Ms. Lanzolotto. A 16-year-old girl, Rosa Grasso, who used to live here, had died in a fire. It really registered with them. While the fire was a colossally sad event, Ms. Sergel said she finds the push for change in factory regulations on safety to be invigorating. In the wake of tragedies like Triangle or 9/11, my sense is there are actually quite wonderful things that come out and radiate from that, she said. There's an immediate dropping of day-to-day falseness. You become much more compassionate and humane toward each other in those moments. It's incumbent upon us, she said, if we're going to commemorate the fire, to commemorate the spirit of action that grew out of the fire. And that was an article in the New York Times last Sunday by Stephen Greenhouse, Out of a Tragedy, A Mission to Remember the Triangle Fire. And there's another commemoration today. Today is Helen Hill's birthday. Now, many of you who are listening probably know Helen and have known her a long time. But maybe many of you don't know that she more or less sponsored the Oregon Open Adoption Rights Bill of 1998. And I'd like to read something I wrote about it. I called it The Right to Know Who You Are. I published it in my newspaper, several years ago, the North Coast Times-Eagle. In late July 2000, Helen Hill spoke to the North Coast Women's Political Caucus in Astoria about the rigors and hardships she encountered to sponsor an initiative petition in the state's government's the state's governments and news media were dead against. The Oregon Open Adoption Rights Bill that was challenged for a year in the courts immediately after it qualified for the 1998 ballot with 100,000 signatures and was elected into law by a significant majority of Oregon voters. A creepy lawyer, and that's a quote, Helen fought against in court represented six unnamed birth mothers who wanted to rescind the vote to protect their identities and save them from shame. And that's a quote. Shame. That was the reason for the campaign, Helen said, to eradicate the shame that hangs over mothers who give up their children for adoption and those like her who are adopted. She said the system's bitter attempt to destroy the bill, ballot measure 58, was a last defense strike for preserving patriarchal control. Helen told how she got involved as sponsor and chief petitioner of an initiative petition. She said that anyone who thinks to become politically involved must ask fundamental questions of themselves about dedication and endurance. She recounted a skeletal frame of how she indeed became dedicated enough to endure the endless filings of paper with interminable bureaucracies, mobilizing petition signature gatherers. She had to resort to paid petitioners, enduring bad press simultaneously with gaining no recognition. Not even by KMUN, which never put her on the air. Yet she said she just tapped into something whose time had come. She credited internet services of adoption finders, in particular Bastard Nation, for its early original work setting up systems and interconnecting support groups. It was as a delegate to a Bastard Nation's convention that she was inspired to write the Open Adoption Records Bill. A political activist noted she was from Oregon, its only delegate, and urged her to utilize the existing initiative process, which few states have. The rest is history. By persevering over official disapproval, and especially the nasty political and personal attacks on her by the corrupt adoption cartel that seals records of adopted children to conceal diseases or infirmities for cash sales to beguiled adopting parents. There was a large market for white babies in the 1950s when she was born and adopted, she said. Yet, despite news blackouts and media attacks, an editorial in the Chicago Tribune suggested she should have been aborted as a fetus, a coarse allusion to adoption as her lifesaver, Helen was supported by passionate allies, particularly adoptees, who, as she said, quote, deserve the right of every other citizen to know who they are, unquote. She stressed the shame that was prevalent among adoptees and birth mothers who let them go, and said her major reason for her campaign for opening birth records of adoptees was to end the shame she believes was especially inculcated in women to protect the identities of anonymous fathers, as well as for the substantial profits trafficking in the bastard baby, that's a quote, trade. Told about the hate mail she received, writers who reviled her as evil. And she told about one letter she received, typically anonymous, started out calling her evil, but then continued on for several pages with the story of the writer's struggles as an adoptee. Helen took out an ad in a newspaper and wished the woman who wrote the letter a happier life. Helen's intent and the reason she was invited to speak to the Women's Political Caucus was to describe the process of political activism. She sketched background, purpose, and her personal experience with power, press, and public. A labyrinth of moves and countermoves, the near fanatic attention to detail necessary to follow a political act to fruition, and always the dedication, fervor, and furious endurance that is indispensable to nurturing and parenting a political idea into mature reality. The personal reward, she said, is in the doing of something she deeply believed must be done and in knowing she was right in what she was doing. She said the best and worst acts by humans are when they act forcibly upon their beliefs, that the noblest deeds in history, and that's a quote, are performed by the believers and also the vilest. Yet it is that belief which creates and sustains the extreme difficulties believing inspires in its struggle to be made real. Helen emphasized that the open adoption law does not force reunions of adoptees and birth parents. Identity and medical records are all that are required to be revealed. Reunions occur. Some turn out bad. Others, like Helen's own, are welcomed and life-altering. Many adoptees are not interested in discovering their real identity, assumedly content as they are, or afraid of who they might turn out to be. The personal stories of adoptees and birth parents are as varied as each experience. The real point behind the Oregon Open Adoption Law is that the freedom and opportunity for adoptees to discover their true identity is open and available for those who choose to use it. It removes an unjust and shameful cloak that disguised wholesale trafficking in babies for the profit of the adoption industry by concealing the identities from all concerned, and most especially from the children themselves. Yet this concealment intensified individual probes into personal identity, which, as Helen compared, like the adoption rights movement, grouped together adoptees in formidable opposition to an unjust status quo. This is the point at which, Helen had said, the right to identify had reached its moment of acceptance and reality. Its time had come, she said. She spoke of a man who described voting as a spiritual process, which defined for her the necessity of keeping Oregon's initiative process open and untampered with. Its excesses will shake out and it will reform itself, she said. It is direct democracy, which is another issue whose time has arrived. Helen described the intense media attention she received after Measure 58 passed but was locked up in a local court. The Today Show television takeover of her Manzanita neighborhood before dawn one morning, she depicted as outer space, with satellite dishes set up to beam and bounce an interview with her directly to Rockefeller Center in New York City. She said she began to understand the Native American belief that cameras steal people's souls. She started to feel she was losing her sense of purpose as well as perspective. She began craving media attention and being jealous when not getting it. She was severely critical of TV news, which she dismissed as artificial and superficial as well as deliberately deceitful, but praised print journalists, whom she said worked hard to get their stories, although they were often incorrect. But the diligence was there, and the attempt to take her vision seriously. In the end, the United States Supreme Court deferred to a lower court decision that upheld Measure 58 as Oregon law, and it went into effect May 31, 2000. The fight was over. It was an important victory, which will eventually germinate all over the country. The mother of three, Helen said during the campaign, "As we grow older, we have vital questions to ask about our parentage because we have children who need to know about future health problems we and they might have inherited." Helen Hill lives in Manzanita, in a house rebuilt from an overnight fire. She remembers repeatedly counting her children that night to be sure they were safe. Writer, artist, doll maker, and art teacher, she is owner-manager of the Bay City Arts Center and the founder, producer, and director of Clouchy Theater. And that was The Right to Know Who You Are. And happy birthday today, Helen. Well, most of you have probably noticed that Sunday was the vernal equinox. So I'd like to read some vernal verse, poems by my deceased friend Arthur Honeyman. In the article about the shirtwaist factory that I read, it mentioned that Ruth Sergel did a project about folks with cerebral palsy. And Arthur was born with cerebral palsy on May 10th, 1940. and spent virtually all his life fighting for people who were physically and mentally handicapped. He graduated with a master's degree and taught at the very college that initially refused him because he had CP and thought he might be too much trouble. And of course, it was for his own safety. But Arthur persevered. All his life, he persevered. So I'd like to read a few things he wrote about spring. Nature after white dawn. After white dawn is gone, and bleak winter has brightened its somber hue with a splash of tender green, traditionally a crocus or daffodil shoots sprouting like a bean, edging its way from its nitrate bed of humus and manure, poking toward a timid birth, shuddering from exposure to the coming glories of life and fears of death. A single bird warbles, announcing the rebirth of spring. A rose arose and awakened. A rose arose from sucking mud, as it does every spring, and awakened in the wake of a seasonal flood, and poked a tender budding shoot up into the last cold breath of winter, mingling with breaths of the fragrant warmth of spring, petals budding and unfolding, cyclically from gentle hibernation into rebirth of rare pulchritude, where crowning beauty reigns and is vigilantly protected by sinuous stalk and thorns to prick bloody-fingered robbers, deigning to pluck its blossom from its graceful, arching stem. For to stop a rose from arising, its roots must be routed and wrenched from its muddy bed, so the dark day may never come, when it can never again be said that a rose arose and awakened. Spring rain in Oregon. Usually an Oregon rain is just mist that softly moistens the landscape and abundantly produces flora and other types of vegetation. But this deluge on a March day is stinking, muck-sucking stuff, which both combats the drought of last year and prepares the way for the annual vernal rebirth by eroding rivulated canals down into the muddy, fertile terrain, so that microbiotic creatures can squirm their ways and etch tracks through suburbia, helping to add humus to the murky foundations for plant life to feed from, while simultaneously and symbiotically reaping the benefits of oxygen provided by herbomorphic entities. For water is more than a drink or thirst-quenching liquid, and all aspects of it help shape this imperfect, spheroidal planet, both above and below its surface, more exquisitely than Michelangelo sculpted the elegant body of David, or the bemuscled torso of a macho godhead angrily pointing Adam and Eve out of paradise forever, as well as much more. For this sparkling, bubbling fluid runs deep in terrestrial existence, recycled from vapor to water to ice, and that is rain for you, even Oregon rain. And tulips. Come, let us put our two lips, you and I, to the natural cups of life, you and I. Wonderful, bulbous, flowering tulips, you and I. Tickling the cilia in our nostrils, you and I. With its sexy pistils and stamens, you and I. Drinking and sniffing their nectar, you and I. For spring is coming for us, you and I. Wonderful, bulbous, flowering tulips, you and I. Come, let us put our two lips, you and I, to the natural cups of life, you and I. And Easter flowers. In the spring of the year, when the lilies trumpet the glory of vernal rebirth with the sounds and colors of nature on parade, with clarity unparalleled in design, by humanity and its symbolism, of Easter heralded by beauty on all fronts from all of life, beginning from germination of a phenomenon accented by the deep fragrance emanated by newly grown grass greening or other tender shoots of young plant life bursting into active blossom perfuming the colors of yellow daffodils and forsythia or the array of rainbow shades in the variety of chalice-like tulips so naturally functional in beauty and design that honeybees and other insects and hummingbirds can drink their fill from the cup of life. And this is what Easter is all about. And those were a few poems written a few springs ago by my friend Arthur Honeyman, who died on December 8th, on the 2008, on the anniversary, actually, of Astoria's Great Fire of 1922. I hope I didn't butcher him too badly. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.